The new cook at Renfell Court could gut a fish in 4 strokes, judge a roasting fire by the back of her hand without holding it to the flame, and tell to the half minute when a custard would turn. And she had done all 3 before the kitchen had finished deciding it did not like her. They had decided that on her first morning when she walked in plain as a Tuesday, brown hair scraped flat, a face nobody would turn to look at twice, a gown the color of dishwater, and set down a small calfskin book on the dresser and rolled her sleeves to the elbow and asked, in a low, even voice, which of them knew where the good knives were kept. The undercook had laughed. The scullery girls had laughed. And Margaret Hartley, who could have bought Renfell Court and every soul laughing in it without troubling the interest on her father's smallest account, had picked up the second best knife and gone to work as though she had not heard. She heard everything. That was rather the point of being there. For Margaret had not come to Renfell to cook, though she cooked better than anyone in the county. She had come to watch, somewhere above the green baize door that separated the kitchens from the great house, lived a man whose entire future her father held in a strongbox in Calcutta House, on the Strand. The mortgages on Renfell, the bills, the long sorry ledger of a dukedom drowning, and somewhere in the post lately had come a proposal of marriage, arranged between men, to settle the whole debt in one tidy stroke. The Duke of Renfell to wed the Nabob Hartley's only daughter, sight unseen, money for blood, blood for money. Margaret Hartley had read that proposal at her father's elbow and said only, "Before I am sold to a stranger, Papa, I should like to know what I am buying." And then she had taken a position in his kitchen under a name plain enough to hide behind, and told no one, and come down to Hampshire to learn for herself what manner of man this duke was before her yes or no decided whether he kept his house or lost it. A year. She gave herself a year. She did not yet know it would take all of it. The first time the Duke of Renfell came below stairs, the whole kitchen straightened like a struck sail, and Margaret did not. She knew it was him before she turned. The kitchen had told her, in the way a kitchen tells you everything, by going silent. And she finished crimping the edge of the pie in her hands before she looked up. Because a thing she had decided early was that she would give this man no deference she had not seen him earn. He was not what the proposal had led her to expect. She had built, out of the word duke and the word debt, a soft, ruined creature who would marry a strongbox to keep his cellars full. The man in the kitchen doorway was lean and dark and tired around the eyes. With a burn scar puckering the back of one hand, and a faint rasp under his voice as though he had once breathed smoke and never entirely got it out, and he had come down himself, not by a servant, to ask the cook whether the kitchen had enough coal for the winter, because his steward had told him to economize, and he would not take warmth from his own scullery to save his own face. "We have enough, Your Grace," Margaret said. "If we are careful." "Be careful, then," he said, "but be warm. I'll not have anyone cold in this house to flatter my accounts." His eyes went round the kitchen once and stopped on the small calfskin book on the dresser, the only thing in the room that did not belong to a kitchen, and then on her plain, unremarkable face, and something flickered there. Not interest, she was too plain for interest, but a kind of arrest, as if her stillness in a room full of bobbing servants had snagged him. "You did not curtsy," he said. "Not unkind." "Curious. I had pastry on my hands, Your Grace. I judged you would rather have the pie than the courtesy." The undercook went white. But the Duke of Renfell, who had not laughed once that anyone below stairs could remember, made a low, rough sound that took the room a moment to recognize as a laugh, and said, "You judged correctly," and went back up the stairs. And Margaret stood with her plain face perfectly calm and her heart, against every plan she had made, beating slightly faster than it had any business to. She wrote nothing in the book that night. There was nothing yet she trusted herself to write. What she learned in the weeks that followed, she learned in the way servants learn, through the floor, through the dumbwaiter, through doors left ajar. And what she learned changed the shape of the thing she had come to decide. The Duke was not drowning Renfell. Renfell was being drowned, deliberately, by a hand that was not his. His cousin did it, Mr. Crispin Marlowe, the Duke's first cousin, and, while Adrian remained unmarried and without a son, the heir presumptive to the whole estate. A smiling, scented, perpetually agreeable man who came down from London to stay for weeks at a time, who signed for things in the Duke's name with the Duke's own trusting leave, who steered the creditors and soothed them, and quietly made certain they were never quite paid. Because a cousin who stands to inherit a dukedom does the arithmetic only one way. Push the Duke far enough into the sea of debt, and one of two things must happen. The estate is sold, or the Duke is married off to money he does not love, and either way a careful cousin waits on the shore for a title that drops, in time, into his open hands. Crispin's reason was as old as inheritance itself, and he could have said it in a single line, and Margaret, listening at the green baize door, heard him very nearly say it. I need only keep him poor and keep him proud, and the rest will see to itself. For the Duke was proud. That was the lever Crispin used. Adrian of Renfell would not sell the house his tenants had farmed for 200 years, and Margaret heard this through the study door one grey afternoon and stood rooted to the cold flags listening. He would not, he told his cousin flatly, marry a fortune he had never met to dig himself out of a hole his own family had dug. The Hartley girl, Crispin purred, the Nabob's daughter. 40,000 if she's a farthing, and the debt evaporates the morning of the wedding. You have only to be agreeable, Adrian, you needn't even like her. They say she's plain as a post and twice as silent. Then I will not insult her, the Duke's rasp came back, low and final, by marrying her for her father's strongbox and giving her a husband who took her like a draught of medicine. She deserves a man who chose her. I cannot be that man for a woman I have never met, bought to mend my roof. Find me another road, Crispin. That one is closed. Margaret Hartley stood on the cold flags below the study, with a copper pan going cold in her hands, and discovered that the decision she had come 140 miles to make had, somewhere in the last half minute, made itself, and that it had nothing to do with the strongbox at all. He noticed her properly on a night the great house dined 20, and the noticing began, as these things do, with something small and went somewhere neither of them intended. A footman dropped a tureen on the service stair, Margaret's pheasant soup, an hour's work, gone across the stones, and the boy stood white and shaking. Because a ruined dish at a duke's table meant a ruined character and the road, and the undercook was already drawing breath to flay him. Margaret put herself between them. It was the worn tread on the fourth stair that dropped it, she said, calm as still water, not his hands. I have nearly gone over on it myself. Mend the stair and you mend the footman. And then, to the trembling boy, lo, go up and say the second course is 5 minutes delayed and the fault is the cook's. They will forgive a cook 5 minutes. Go on. She had a second soup standing by the fire before the undercook had finished her first breath. Because she had learned, in her father's vast and anxious household, that you keep a second of everything when the people above you are the kind who break things, and the people below you are the kind who pay for it. She did not know the Duke had come down again until she heard the rasp behind her. You took the blame, he said, for a stare. The stare could not take it for itself, Your Grace. He was quiet a moment. The kitchen had gone still around them, pretending not to listen, listening with all its might. My cousin, the Duke said slowly, tells me I am a fool for coming down to my own kitchens. He says a man of my rank should not know the cook's name. A pause. I find I do not know it. No one has thought to ask it, Margaret said, and was surprised by the small clean edge in her own voice. Surprised that after a year of being looked through, it had found a place to cut. I have fed this house since the spring, Your Grace. Every soul under this roof has eaten from my hands 3 times a day for the better part of a year. And not one of them, not the undercook, not the steward, not your gentle cousin, not yourself, has once thought to ask the name of the woman who keeps you all alive. It landed. She watched it land, watched the rasp catch in his throat, watched the man behind the title come briefly to the surface of his tired eyes. And she understood that she had wounded him, and that he had let her, which is a different and more dangerous thing. "Tell me your name," he said. "Margaret," she said, after a moment. "Only that. Not Hartley. Not yet. They call me Meg. Below, Margaret," he repeated, as if testing the weight of it, and the plain, unremarkable name in his smoke-roughened voice did something to the air of the kitchen that neither of them acknowledged. "I shall not forget it again." Below stairs, the undercook would say afterward that she knew that very night how it would go, because the Duke of Renfell had said the plain cook's name the way other men said grace. He came down often after that, on errands that grew thinner as the weeks shortened toward winter. The coal, the candles, a question about the tenant's Christmas, until at last he stopped pretending there was an errand at all. They talked across the scrub deal table after the kitchen had gone to bed, the banked fire ticking, a single rushlight between them. And Margaret learned the man, and the man learned the cook. And each of them was hiding exactly one enormous thing from the other, and neither of them knew the other was hiding anything. "You hold your knife like a soldier," he said one night, watching her bone afoul by the light of the single rushlight. "Not like a cook. A cook coaxes. You command." "My mother taught me," Margaret said, "that you may coax a man and you may command a knife, but never the reverse, or you will be cut and he will be spoiled. Your mother sounds a formidable woman. She married for love, and was cut by her family for it, and never once said she was sorry. She was the most formidable woman I have known." She set the knife down. "And yours, your grace? You speak of your father, the debts, the cousin, never your mother." He was quiet a moment, turning the rushlight so the small flame leaned. "She died when I was 9. My father spent the next 20 years teaching me that softness was a thing other men used against you, and he was an apt teacher, and I was an apt pupil, and the lesson nearly cost a child its life the night that cottage burned, because I stood in the yard for the space of 3 heartbeats deciding whether a duke was permitted to run into a fire." The rasp in his voice thickened. "I have never told anyone that. That I waited. 3 heartbeats. I have carried them for 11 years. "You went up the stair," Margaret said gently. "The waiting is not the part that matters. The going is. Is that what your formidable mother would have said?" "It is what her daughter says, having watched you say the cook's name like grace and come down to a cold kitchen to be sure the scullery had coal." She had not meant to say so much. It came out of her before her caution could catch it. "You are not the man your father made, Adrian Renfell. You are the man who went up the stair. I wish you would believe it." He looked at her then the way no one in that house had looked at her, not through the plain face but past it, to the thing behind it, and the kitchen seemed to grow very small and very warm around the rushlight. So she learned the man, night by night, across the scrubbed deal table. She learned that he read his own accounts now, every line, twice, since the year he discovered how much of the ruin had been signed in his name by a hand he trusted. She learned that he was lonelier than any man she had ever met, and prouder, and that the pride was not vanity but the last wall standing between him and a despair he did not let anyone see. And one night, reaching at the same moment for the same calfskin book where she had begun, at last, to write a few careful lines, their hands met on the worn cover and neither moved. The rushlight guttered. He turned her hand over in his, The burned hand and the work roughened one, tracing without seeming to know he did it the old white scar across her thumb, where a knife had slipped when she was 12, and learning at her mother's side. The whole quiet kitchen seemed to lean in around the small flame. His head bent toward hers, slowly, giving her every moment in the world to draw away, and she did not draw away. And she felt the warmth come off him, and the rasp of his breath and her own treacherous breath go shallow to meet it. And the want in it was so enormous, so far past anything in her careful plan, that it frightened her more than discovery ever had. An inch. Less, she could have counted the heartbeats between them, and there were not many, and they were not slow. "Margaret," he said, very low, against the silence. And it was a question, her name and nothing else. And everything else folded inside it. And because it was a question, and because she could not answer it honestly without answering everything, she drew her hand back. "Your Grace," she said, and her voice was not steady, "you do not know who I am." "I know exactly who you are," he said. "You are the only honest person in my house." Which was the one thing she was not, and the kindness of it, the terrible wrongness of it, was worse than any cruelty. And she rose and banked the fire and bade him good night, and lay awake until dawn with the unwritten truth sitting on her chest like a stone. The thing blew open at Christmas, the way such things do, at the worst possible hour, and in the most public room. Crispin had grown impatient. A creditor he could no longer hold off had been brought down to Renfell for the Christmas dinner. A Mr. Prince of the City, a hard small man with a fistful of the Duke's paper, and the cousin's plan was elegant and cruel. Let Prince press for the whole sum at the table, before the assembled neighbours, so that Adrian, humiliated past bearing, would have no choice but to write that very night to accept the Hartley marriage, the only money fast enough to save him. Crispin had even, Margaret would learn, written ahead to her father in the Duke's name, all but accepting the match, to have it ready. What Crispin did not know, what no one in that bright candlelit room knew as the soup went up and the creditor sharpened his courtesies, was that the Hartley money was already in the house. It had been in the house since spring. It was downstairs, in a dishwater gown, plating the fish. Margaret heard the trap close through the dumbwaiter shaft, every word of it rising up the cold brick throat into the kitchen as clearly as if she had been seated at the table. "I am sorry to raise so coarse a matter at so fine a board," came the creditor's small hard voice, oiled with false reluctance. "But business is business, Your Grace. And the sum is now called in entire. £11,000. Tonight, or the proceedings begin in the new year. And a duke in chancery is a sight the papers do dearly love." A pause, exquisitely timed. "Of course, were Your Grace to have happy news of an alliance to announce, a betrothal say, the matter might yet be held over. I am a reasonable man. I read the betrothal notices as eagerly as the next." Margaret, gripping the dresser below, understood the whole shape of it at once. Crispin had built the cage, and now Prunce was holding the only door open, and the door led straight to the Hartley strongbox. And 20 neighbours sat watching to see the proud Duke of Renfell forced through it in front of them all. She heard Crispin's purr slide in beneath. "Surely, cousin, on a night like this, with friends about you, surely there is news you might share." "The Hartley business. Only say the word, and Mr. Prunce goes home content, and we may all return to the goose." And then she heard the Duke do the one thing she had not dared hope for, and Crispin had not thought to fear. He refused. "You may have your judgment, Mr. Prunce," the Duke said, in the voice of a man stepping off a cliff with his eyes open. "And you may have the house, in time, by law, as is your right. What you may not have is my name on a marriage contract to a woman I have never met, bought to spare me this hour. I'll lose Renfell with my honour before I'll keep it without." A chair scraped. When the rasp came again, it was quiet enough that the whole table must have strained toward it. "I have read the betrothal notices too, sir," There is a woman's name in every one of them, and behind each name a woman, who deserves better than to learn one day that her husband took her the way a drowning man takes a rope, without looking, only because it was there. My cousin will tell you I am a fool. A pause, into a silence you could have heard a candle gutter in. He has told me so himself. Often, he may even be sincere. It was the bravest, most ruinous thing Margaret had ever heard a man do, and he had done it for the principle of a woman he believed he would never meet, choosing ruin over a loveless purchase, choosing it in public, irreversibly, before he knew that the woman in question was the one who had drawn her hand back from his across a kitchen table a fortnight before. He had chosen Margaret without knowing she and the strongbox were the same. And Crispin, his elegant plan collapsing, did the thing that desperate clever men do. He reached for the nearest cruelty to hand. How noble, the cousin said, soft and venomous. And how convenient, cousin, that your sudden tender conscience arrives the very season you've been creeping down to moon over a kitchen drab every night the house is obeyed. Oh, the servants talk, Adrian. The whole county will talk. The Duke of Renfell, too fine to marry an honest fortune, rutting after his own cook. He smiled. Have her up. Let your guests see the great romance you'd trade a dukedom for. Let us all meet. What is it they call her? Meg. The cost arrived dressed as a Christmas dinner, and it fell on both of them at once. They sent for the cook to be displayed and shamed, and Margaret climbed the green baize stair into the candlelight with her dishwater gown and her flat brown hair and her plain, unremarkable face. And 20 of the finest people in Hampshire turned to look at the drab the Duke would beggar himself over, and began, softly, to laugh. Adrian did not laugh. Adrian stood white and stricken at the head of his own table, and the look he turned on her was not the look of the man across the rushlight. It was the look of a man who has just understood that the one honest person in his house has been something other than honest, that she has had a name she would not give him, and a reason for being there she never named. And the betrayal in his smoked dark eyes was worse than the laughter, because she had put it there herself, with a year of silence. Tell them, Meg, Crispin said, enjoying it now. Tell his grace's noble guests who you are, and Margaret Hartley, who had been laughed at on her first morning and every morning since, who had fed every soul in that house 3 times a day for the better part of a year, while not one of them troubled to ask her name, looked slowly around the long bright table at all the laughing mouths, and let them laugh, and waited, the way she had learned to wait, until the waiting itself began to frighten them. Then, she told them. My name, she said, into the candlelight, in the same low even voice she had used to ask where the good knives were kept, is Margaret Hartley. My father is Mr. Samuel Hartley, of Calcutta House, on the Strand. She watched the name go round the table like cold water poured down a collar. He holds every mortgage on Renfell Court, every bill, every farthing of the paper Mr. Prunce was sent down to wave at you tonight, Mr. Prunce works for my father, gentlemen. He has done these 6 months, though I see by his face he did not expect to find me carving the goose. She set her hands quietly on the back of an empty chair. I am the fortune your Duke was offered and was too honorable to take. I have been in his kitchen since the spring, because I would not be sold to a stranger sight unseen, and I came to learn what manner of man my money was meant to buy. The laughter had stopped. It had stopped all at once, as if a hand had closed over the whole table at the same moment. The matron who had turned her shoulder, the gentleman who had called her a drab into his wine, the undercook who had laughed on the first morning and crept up now to gape from the service door, every laughing mouth in that house shut in the same breath. In the dead silence that followed, the only sound in the great dining room of Renfell Court was the small, steady tick of the fire, and the breathing of 20 people who had, a moment ago, been laughing at a cook, and who would spend the rest of their lives explaining that of course they never had. She did not look at the Duke yet. She looked at his cousin, and Crispin Marlowe, for the first time since she had come to that house, was not smiling. You wrote to my father in the Duke's name, she said to him, pleasantly accepting the match. I have the letter. It was forwarded to me, here, in this kitchen, 3 weeks ago, addressed to Mrs. Hartley, which my father in his humor permitted, since it was I who would answer it. You signed it with your cousin's name and your own scheme, Mr. Marlowe. And in it you were so good as to lay out, in your own hand, precisely how deep you had sunk this estate, and precisely how you meant to profit when it drowned. She drew the folded paper from her apron. She had carried it there for 3 weeks, against her heart, the way she had once walked into this kitchen carrying nothing but her own plain courage. My father read everything twice. He taught me how. Mr. Prunce, you will collect Renfell's debts as instructed, but you will collect them from Mr. Marlowe, who incurred the half of them by fraud, and not one farthing more from his grace, whose only crime in this whole sorry account was to be too proud to be bought, and too kind to ask his cook her name. They took the letter from her hand and read it, and passed it down the silent table, and by the time it reached the foot of the board, Crispin Marlowe had risen, and was reaching, too late, for the dignity of the door, and two of the neighbors had risen to bar it. And the heir presumptive of Renfell walked out of that house under guard into the Christmas dark, and out of the line of inheritance forever, ruined by a single letter, and a woman he had called a drab. Only then did Margaret turn to the Duke. He had not moved. He stood at the head of his table looking at her as though the floor of the world had tilted under him and was still settling. And she saw the betrayal in his face war with something larger, and she did not wait to learn which would win, because she had sworn, long ago, never again to stand and wait on the wrong side of any door. You are angry, she said, lo, for him alone, crossing to him through the wreckage of the dinner. You have the right. I had a name I would not give you and a reason I never spoke, but before you decide what I am, Adrian Renfell, hear me, because I will say it only once. She stopped before him, plain face lifted, steady, stop standing there deciding whether I deceived you. I am not the wrong you must answer tonight, that walked out the door under guard. Ask me instead what I intend to do, because I came to this house to decide whether to ruin you, and I have decided. And the decision is this. I will tear up every bill my father holds against Renfell as a wedding gift, and ask nothing for it, on one condition only, that you marry the woman who fed your household for a year, and not the strongbox you were too good to take. Choose Margaret. You have already done it once tonight, in front of all of them, when you thought she was no one. I am only asking you to do it again, now that you know she is the one who holds your house. For a long moment the rasp would not come. The tired dark eyes searched her plain, unremarkable face, the face he had said he knew exactly, and had been right about all along. And what broke across it at last was not the cold of betrayal, but the warmth of a man who has spent a year lonelier than anyone knew, and has just been told he need not be, by the only person he had wanted to hear it from. I told you, he said, hoarse, that you were the only honest person in my house. And I have just been honest, she said, at considerable cost to my disguise. Will you have me, Your Grace? The cook, the fortune, the year of silence and all. He answered her not in words, but in the way he closed the last of the distance between them, and took her plain face in his burned and gentle hands. There in the ruined candlelight, in front of the silent neighbors and the gaping servants and the cold remains of the goose, and kissed her like a man coming in at last from a long winter on the wrong side of his own gate, and below stairs, when the news of it came down the dumbwaiter. The undercook who had laughed on the first morning sat down very suddenly on a flour barrel and did not say anything at all. They were married at Renfell in the spring, and the calfskin receipt book went up from the kitchen to the still room of the lady of the house, where it sits yet. It had been her mother's. That was the thing Margaret had never told anyone below stairs, that the small worn book in the plain cook's apron was filled, page after page, in the hand of a gentlewoman who had married a Calcutta merchant for love, and been cut by her family for it, and who had taught her daughter that there is no shame in any honest work, and no honor in any unkind word, and had died too soon to see her daughter prove it in a duke's kitchen. The duke read the book through, twice, the first winter of their marriage, and at the back, in the same dear hand, found the recipe for the almond cake his new wife made every Christmas thereafter for the whole household, gentry and servants together at one long table, because she had decided there would be no more rooms in that house where some ate, and others only served. Crispin Marlowe was prosecuted on the evidence of his own letter, stripped of his expectations, and went abroad to the continent to live small and quiet, on an allowance the new Duchess settled on him herself. Not from softness, she said, but because a man should never be made so desperate again that he has nothing left to lose. Mist Prunce, who turned out to be honest after all once he was pointed the right way, stayed on as the estate's man of business, and learned to read everything twice, and in the warm months, when the kitchen door stood open to the garden, the Duke of Renfell could often be found below stairs of an evening, in his shirt sleeves, at the scrubbed deal table where it had begun, not because a man of his rank should know the cook's name, but because the cook was his wife, and he had spent a year nearly losing her to his own failure to ask one plain question. And he had decided he would spend the rest of his life asking it. Margaret, he would say, only that, across the banked fire and the single rushlight. And she would look up from her mother's book, the plain, unremarkable woman who had fed his whole house for a year while not one of them thought to ask her name, and answer him, every time, as though it were the first and the best thing anyone had ever said to her. Yes, she would say, I'm here.